other countries and stuff for help. So, yes, I think this is the first of many problems.
Surging gas prices across the United Kingdom are turning into a full-blown crisis as the British government holds emergency talks while energy companies collapse one after another. Nobody seems able to stop this trend. There is now even growing talk of urgently reopening coal-fired power stations to generate energy and stop blackouts.
The British government is considering emergency state-backed loans to energy companies in a bid to encourage firms to take on customers. But with the prices out of control, the supply limited, and the country out of cash, when it comes to saving companies that were once profitable but now can't even afford to trade, it may already be too late. As the lights go off for energy companies, the worry is that the lights could start going off for Britain next.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Islamic Republic of Iran means what it says regarding peace, stability, sovereignty, and mutual trust in the neighborhood, which is unfortunately being infiltrated by terrorists, Zionists, U.S. imperialists, and their local agents bent upon creating tension and discord in a region where the people share historic affinity. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writers. This article is published under the heading, Iran's Loud and Clear Warning Rattles Intruders. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The Islamic Republic of Iran means what it says regarding peace, stability, sovereignty, and mutual trust in the neighborhood, which is unfortunately being infiltrated by terrorists, Zionists, U.S. imperialists, and our local agents bent upon creating tension and discord in a region where the people share historic affinity. Tehran has therefore given friendly advices to regional countries to not let seditious outsiders set foot on their soil, and warned the infiltrators of swift and decisive action against them if they remain anywhere near its borders. One of those messages of peace was tweeted in several languages, including Hebrew, by Ali Shamkhani, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, SNSC.
Thank you.
Ali Shamkhani's recent tweet reads, "Powerful Iran has always been benevolent to its neighbors and never posed a threat to them. Problems will be resolved with the cooperation of all countries in the region. Any foreign influence is fruitless, so we call on neighbors to be vigilant in this regard and to stay away from the outsiders." The intended audiences have taken note of Shamkhani's friendly message, and hopefully the unwarranted tension of the recent months as a result of irrational developments, especially across our northwestern borders, would subside. If not, the Islamic Republic, which is holding the military maneuvers codenamed Conquerors of Khaybar, derived from the Prophet of Islam's victorious campaign against the seditious Israelites of the fortress of the same name, who were planning to attack Medina, but were overpowered thanks to the valor of Imam Ali, peace upon him, will have no other choice but to take swift preventive action against the infiltrators. Perhaps the best piece of advice in this regard was delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, during his recent video address to the joint graduation ceremony for cadets of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Armed Forces Academies at Imam Hussein, peace upon him, University. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei did not mince words when he pointed to the rational approach of the Islamic Republic to the problems it faces and invited regional nations to act rationally. He said, "Other governments had better act rationally as well and prevent the region from having a serious problem, because those who dig a hole for their brothers fall in it first." He added, "The issues concerning Iran's northwestern neighbors should be resolved wisely by relying on the people through the cooperation of the armies of neighboring countries and by avoiding the presence of any foreign military forces." The leader warned against foreign interference in the region, since allowing foreign militaries to intervene or have a military presence in the region brings nothing but discord and damage.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol during the Congress meeting to certify Joe Biden's presidential election victory revealed the deep division within the American society and political system. Now, months after the incident, a new poll has showcased the extreme divisions between the two major U.S. political parties, that are Democrats and Republicans. To find out how deep the divisions run, the University of Virginia Center for Politics and Project Home Fire surveyed 2012 voters during the summer. Half of the participants had voted for Donald Trump and the other half for President Joe Biden. Not surprisingly, the results showed a country at ideological war with itself. The responses supporting the idea of forming two new countries out of red and blue states range from at least somewhat agree to strongly agree. Indeed, 52% of Trump voters and 41% of Biden voters expressed support for cleaving the country along political lines. The poll also found that 80% or more of both Biden and Trump voters fear the effects of the other party's policies. As a matter of fact, they said the opposing side presents a clear and present danger to American democracy. In addition, roughly 2 in 10 Trump and Biden voters strongly agreed with the idea of a president bypassing Congress or courts to take needed actions.
The real issue here is the weakening of democracy in the first place, which helps support or enable these notions of secession or mutual hatred.
Furthermore, a June poll found voters saw political division as the top issue the United States faces, beating out the COVID-19 pandemic, healthcare, and economic issues. If not dealt with properly and swiftly, the extreme division in the U.S. could turn into a full-blown crisis with dangerous ramifications. It could lead to incidents such as the January 6th attack on Capitol. On that day, a large number of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, where the U.S. Congress was meeting to certify Biden's presidential election win. Over 500 people have been arrested in connection with the attack. Also, about 140 officers from both the Capitol Police and the D.C. Department were injured. 4 people died in the attack, including a senior police officer. The U.S. also faces another challenge that is gaining steam, a national divorce. A Texas pro-independence group named the Texas Nationalist Movement is trying to push a referendum vote on the independence of the state, dubbed Texit. Also, support for the secession of California from the U.S., named Calexit, is rising. As of September 2020, the California pro-independence groups got approval again to collect petition signatures.
It's dangerous because what you have is one-third of the population who are increasingly convinced that the government is illegitimate. And when you have that, you also now have the mobilization of a section of these people to attack the very instruments of government.
Violence and secession are two probable outcomes of the continuation of the current trend within the U.S. political system. It's high time Washington came up with a plan to heal its fractured democracy, or watch its house of cards burn gradually.
The United States has seen several high-profile incidents of police violence and brutality in recent years, whose victims are mostly members of minority communities in America. The death of African-American George Floyd in May 2020 sparked a new wave of widespread protests not only in the U.S., but across the whole world. Following the incidents, a group of researchers has collected data about police killings in America over the span of about 40 years. The study published in the peer-reviewed Lancet Journal has found glaring discrepancies between figures reported by a governmental database and those compiled by open-source databases. According to the article, over half of all police-involved killings in the country have been either misclassified or unreported. Moreover, the researchers found that the governmental database misclassified nearly 60% of all fatal police encounters involving African Americans. The database is also reported to have missed 50% of all police-involved deaths of Hispanic people. The disproportionate police targeting of African Americans has been highlighted in previous research. However, the latest meta-analysis is considered as having the longest study period to date. Possible conflicts of interest have also been cited in the extensive research, as the authors noted that investigators are embedded inside police departments and can be discouraged from determining that the deaths are caused by police violence.
The U.S. government, the Department of Justice, the bureaucracies within the U.S. state are going to do everything they can to hide these because it's already bad. And the U.S. wants to maintain its veneer of being a progressive, a woke, a haven of social justice and international community.
The paper highlighted the importance of increased use of open source data collection to investigate acts of discrimination by the U.S. police. Targeted changes to policing and safety protocols were also cited as possible solutions to the increasingly pressing problem. In reality, however, many U.S. politicians seem to remain opposed to such changes. Last month, bipartisan talks in the United States Senate for a police reforms bill broke down without a deal. The bill was passed in the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives in March. The reforms, dubbed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, were proposed following the death of the African-American man at the hands of a white Minneapolis officer last year. The law would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. President Joe Biden accused Republicans of rejecting even modest reform.
They have something in stake in, you know, arresting disproportionately African-American communities. They have something in stake, be it personal prejudice or be it economic gain.
In such a political climate, the rising trend of killings isn't likely to be reversed anytime soon. That won't be good news for President Biden, who has a strong base of black voters.
Iran and Venezuela are deepening their economic cooperation despite U.S. pressures and sanctions. The 2.1 million barrel cargo of condensate supplied by the Iranian National Oil Company to Venezuela, the first of a swap deal between the two countries, began discharging this week. The condensate shipment arrived in Venezuelan waters late last week, aboard a large Iran-flagged crude tanker called Dino 1. The ship is owned and operated by the National Iranian Oil Company. The shipment comes amid a huge swap deal between the two allies. Venezuela has agreed to a key contract to swap its heavy oil for Iranian condensate that it can use to improve the quality of its crude. The agreement is reportedly planned to last for 6 months in its first phase, but could be extended. Venezuela seeks to use the Iranian condensate to mix it with its crude to improve the quality of the oil for exports. That would also allow Caracas to supply its lighter oil to refineries in the country to produce badly needed motor fuel.
Venezuela must have the lighter fuel, which Iran is able to provide, in order for its heavier fuel to even move through pipelines. So it's an essential trade. The U.S. has stopped Venezuela and has refused to provide it. In past years, decades, the U.S. provided this to Venezuela. It was normal exchange. It's been cut off by sanctions.
Iran's supply of condensate can help Venezuela to increase its crude exports, as the country needs the revenues to improve an economy that has suffered because of U.S. sanctions. The deal could be a breach of U.S. sanctions on both nations.
The sanctions on Iran, on Venezuela, on 39 countries in the world today are absolutely illegal, have no basis in international law. This is unilateral action by the U.S. government that targets any country where they're trying to orchestrate a regime change.
Sanctions on Iran and Venezuela have made it difficult for both countries. That has spurred Iran to support Venezuela. U.S. sanctions programs not only forbid Americans from doing business with oil sectors of Iran and Venezuela, but also threaten to impose secondary sanctions against any non-U.S. person or entity that carries out transactions with either country's oil companies.
And it is a tactic, really it's a crime against humanity. It is a tactic to destabilize the economy of countries around the world. It is it's a tactic to create shortages and to stop the normal trade relations that exist among countries of the world. All of this has no basis in international law. It is just sheer thuggery.
Secondary sanctions can carry a range of penalties against those targeted, including cutting off access to the U.S. financial system, fines, or the freezing of U.S. assets. U.S. sanctions are often applied at the discretion of the administration in power. Earlier in September, the U.S. siege on Lebanon was broken after the country's resistance movement, Hezbollah, imported fuel from Iran via Syria.
And now countries around the world, and it's noteworthy Iran's role in standing up to the U.S. sanctions, in sending an important shipment of desperately needed fuel to Lebanon through Syria. There's three sanctioned countries, each being literally destabilized by U.S. efforts to sanction all exchange, all trade, and even all access to very needed, for Lebanon, very needed fuel.
The United States has imposed sanctions against Lebanon to pressure the country over the influence that Hezbollah wields in its political and military sectors. It appears that Iran's oil and energy deals with Venezuela and Lebanon have broken the U.S. hegemony on the global stage and has opened the way for independent and sovereign states to conduct business based on their mutual interests.
Bahrain and Israel have taken their relationship a step further, with Israel inaugurating its embassy in Manama. Israel has opened diplomatic relations with four Arab League countries, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Morocco. It had signed peace agreements with Egypt and Jordan, but these normalization of ties have one major flaw. It goes against the Palestinian cause.
It does, and that's deliberate. That is why Israel wanted these relationships. Yes, it's meant to further Israel's goals of marginalizing the Palestinians and ultimately removing them from Palestine.
Israel violates Palestinian rights on a daily basis. This is one major reason why the citizens of these countries Israel has normalized ties with are against the diplomatic relations. Former U.S. President Donald Trump began this process under what was called the Abraham Accord. Aside from naming Al-Quds as Israel's capital, it pushed these Arab nations to normalize ties with Bahrain. In one sense, this move is criticized for giving legitimacy to Israeli violations against Palestinians. Bahrainis have rejected this step, with the main opposition group Al-Wafaq and the top cleric denouncing the kingdom's normalization of ties with Israel. Al-Wafaq went on to say that the regime doesn't have the right to do so.
It's true that probably a majority, probably a large majority of Bahrainis are against this so-called normalization with Israel. But there are powerful influences on Bahrain, Britain, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and they all are essentially forcing the issue without objection from the monarchy in Bahrain. So I think they are the ones who are calling the shots here, not the people of Bahrain.
It was not mandated by its people to establish relations with the Zionist entity. Thus, any communication or relations with the occupying regime is rejected and condemned. Our people will not accept it and deal with it as a threat to their stability and existence. Israel has been more than happy to have relationships established with the Arab countries, since the closer it gets with the Arab nations and normalized ties, the less afraid it is of its existence being in danger and thus acquire more legitimacy. At the same time, this gives Israel an opportunity to monitor the actions of these Arab nations in case there are any moves taken against Israel. In the case of the UAE, Israel has not only expanded its trade relations, but it has also set up surveillance operations with it, one of the reasons to monitor the actions of Iran. Israel and the UAE have even taken a step further and set up a surveillance center in the Yemeni island of Socotra. The same may also happen with Bahrain, especially given its close proximity to Iran. In the meantime, the anger of the Arab residents of these countries that have normalized ties with Israel is boiling over.
Israel is an expansionist country. It has been from the beginning of its existence. It wants to expand. It's basically an imperialist nation, even though it's small in size. But it has imperialist ambitions.
decades of Arab consensus that there will be no ties with Israel, while the Palestinian question remains unresolved, is being trampled on. US's push on the so-called deal of the century was a complete failure, which has joined the dustbin of history. Maybe that is why these so-called normalizations are taking place.
It's another means of pressure. It's, going through other Arab countries who have the monarchies, the Gulf monarchies, basically have realigned their alliances with the and they're doing the bidding of Israel and the United States and the Western countries. So they've decided to essentially abandon the Palestinians.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations to the seminaries and religious scholars of ulama, which were issued in his faithful message and also in his testament. In today's program, we're going to touch upon Imam's advice to the executive branch of the government, especially the foreign ministry and Iranian diplomats. Stay with us for more. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to stress that if the executive branch of the government is not reformed, no remarkable result would be gained for the nation, even if there were good laws. He wrote in his testament, "Among the affairs that need to be reformed, purified, and cared for is the executive branch of the government. Sometimes progressive and useful laws may be passed in the parliament, and the Guardian Council may approve it, and the relevant minister may proclaim it, but it may go to unrighteous executors so that they would annul it, and contrary to the rules, or with the bureaucracies and twisting that they have got used to, or intentionally, they act in a way to make people worried, to gradually cause a row." Imam Khomeini considered honest bond with people and rendering services to them, especially to the less well-off and deprived classes, as an undeniable necessity of the Islamic Republic. He used to emphasize that neglecting the principle is religiously forbidden and would incur divine wrath. The Imam wrote, the budget from which you and the employees of the ministries are paid from belongs to the nation. You should be the servants of the nation, especially the oppressed. And you should know that causing trouble for people and acting opposite to their duty is haram or religiously forbidden, and God forbid would sometimes incur divine wrath. All of you need the nation's support. It was with the people's support, particularly the less well-off and the deprived classes, that victory was achieved, and the hand of the oppressive kingdom was cut off from the country and its reserves. And if one day you are deprived of their support, you will be put aside, and like the oppressive royal regime, oppressors would occupy the posts instead of you. In view of this tangible reality, you must try to draw the people's attention and refrain from un-Islamic and inhumane behavior. Khomeini, may God bless his soul, said in a famous speech to cabinet ministers and the government, he said, "Serve this nation which has cut off the treacherous hands and has put its trust in you. As long as you are such, the nation will back you, and as long as the nation accompanies you, no harm will occur to you and the country." The Imam writes to the foreign ministry and diplomats, "I recommend the foreign minister in this era and the next era to be heedful that your responsibility is very much either in the reformation and development of the ministry and embassies or the foreign ministry, safeguarding the independence of this country and the interests of this country, and good relations with governments which don't intend to meddle in our country's affairs. And seriously refrain from anything that is suspicious of dependence with all of its dimensions. And know that dependence in some affairs, although it may have a deceptive appearance or interest and use for the time being, however, it would draw the country to destruction." Imam Khomeini believed that an important step towards independence of the foreign ministry is to reinforce bonds with Islamic countries, and asked the diplomatic missions to embark on awakening the Islamic countries and inviting Muslim nations to unity and solidarity. The Imam wrote, "I recommend to the nations of Islamic countries not to expect anyone from abroad to help you in reaching the goal which is Islam and executing Islamic laws and rules. You yourselves should rise up for this vital affair which will materialize freedom and independence." And the great religious scholars and respectful preachers of Islamic countries should invite governments to get rid of dependence on big foreign powers and to rely on their own abilities. In this way, they will embrace victory. And they should invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to the rule of Islam. And shake hands of brotherhood with their brethren in faith in any country and with any race, as the great Islam has called on them as brothers. And if one day this brotherhood in faith materializes with the efforts of governments and nations and the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power on earth. Imam Khomeini also warns staff of the foreign ministry by saying, "Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, I have issued recommendations to foreign ministers about development of embassies, which should be compatible with Islamic Republic. Yet, some of them either didn't want to or failed to take any positive action." Thank you.
10 minutes.
September 21st, 2021, New York. U.S. President addressing the U.S. General Assembly.
The United States will compete and will compete vigorously and lead with our values and our strength. We'll stand up for our allies and our friends and oppose attempts by stronger countries to dominate weaker ones, whether through changes to territory by force, economic coercion, technical exploitation, or disinformation. But we're not seeking, say it again, we are not seeking a new Cold War or a world divided into rigid blocks.
This is not the first time that a U.S. president is attacking China in his speech. Joe Biden is the latest man in the White House who is showing his bare teeth to Beijing. 10 months ago, when Donald Trump was campaigning for his re-election, he blamed Biden for not taking China's rise seriously.
Joe Biden didn't just side with China on the virus. He did. He called me again. Xenophobic. That's what he said. You all heard it many times. He described the rise of China as, quote, a very positive development. Not a positive development. Not for us, it's not. He said that the idea that China is our competition is really bizarre. He's really bizarre.
But now, 8 months into Biden's presidency, the world can see that the ties between Washington and Beijing are still at rock bottom. All the offensive rhetoric behind Trump's trade war may be gone, but the way Biden is challenging China looks even more serious. And in general, the U.S. continues to challenge China in every possible way, in terms of military, economy, technology, diplomacy, and even international leadership on global health. Biden says the U.S. does not seek yet another Cold War, but the question is, if Washington is not looking for another Cold War, why does it continue the bitter rivalry? The answer is simple, because China matters to many of the U.S. allies. Over the past couple of decades, China has increased its economic, political, and to a lesser extent, security footprint across the world. These days, China is the biggest trade partner and external investor for many countries. No matter if the country is wealthy or not, China gives them a deal compatible with their resources. This has been good for almost everybody, particularly the wealthy Arab nations of the Middle East. Some of these countries have been traditional allies of the U.S. since their creation, and now, with China rising in every possible aspect, it seems that these traditional partners are shifting from the West to the East. For example, the United Arab Emirates, which has been one of Washington's closest allies, is getting closer to China day by day. For decades, the UAE has been investing heavily in U.S. assets, buying billions of dollars of U.S.-made weaponry and supporting America's foreign policies, from the occupation of Afghanistan to intervening in Libya's affairs. But now, the UAE is doing more business with China. Washington seems unhappy, and as a result, it has taken an increasingly hawkish stance towards Beijing. For the past 5 years, the U.S. has constantly brought up China-related issues into the spotlight. It warned European partners about security consequences of using Chinese technology, such as Huawei's 5G telecommunications network.
The new U.S. measures restrict Huawei's ability to produce important products using U.S. technology or software. The National Cybersecurity Center has reviewed the consequences of the U.S.'s actions. the NCSC has now reported to ministers that they have significantly changed their security assessment of Huawei's presence in the UK's 5G network.
Until quite recently, the leaders of most of the Persian Gulf countries were totally dependent on the United States. For them, Washington was a reliable partner that guaranteed their security and even existence. At the same time, the US looked at them as a reliable source for global energy. But figures show that US oil imports from these countries have declined in the past decade, all as a result of the gas boom in North America. At the same time, Asia's demand for oil has been soaring up every day, and that resulted in a China-Arab states relationship which has now become more than energy supplies. The young generation of Arab states are seeking to make their countries more modernized in the most cost-effective ways, and Chinese technology has been a great help. From artificial intelligence to armed drones, healthcare or renewable energy, China has an answer for everything. The latest is the announcement by Saudi Arabia. Riyadh said that it would use China's Huawei's 5G technology in NEOM, the futuristic city it's building in Tabuk province. And the deal was clinched despite Washington's opposition. Arab states still insist that the United States is their number one ally. They say there is a historical security relationship, and they have made massive investments in the US, particularly in treasury bills. For years, young Arabs have studied in American schools and universities and feasted on its movies, soap operas, and music. Arab officials also have time and again assured Washington that there is no prospect of China replacing the US as the dominant foreign military power in the region or the main exporter of arms to the Persian Gulf states. But there's a catch. Like every other leader, Arab countries don't want to put all their eggs in one basket. They are naturally looking to diversify their relations and project their power through border alliances. For this purpose, they looked around and apparently they have found the East a good replacement for the West. It's actually a wise move. China provides the same technology, only cheaper and a lot more available. As the Huawei 5G technology, even the European countries couldn't resist it. Meanwhile, Beijing is willing to sell weaponry equipment that Washington refuses to sell to Arabs. After all, there's no Congress to approve or halt the sale, and China is already the biggest buyer of Arab states' oil. It's a win-win situation for everyone, except the United States. Last year, Washington refused to sell armed drones to Arab states, as Israel is its greatest ally. The US gives its most advanced weaponry to Tel Aviv and no other country in the region, so that the regime can maintain its military superiority over the Arab states of the region. After Washington's refusal, both Riyadh and Abu Dhabi inevitably turned to China. Another sign of the Arab states shifting towards China can be seen in the recent world health crisis. The UAE turned to China for the COVID-19 vaccine. At the same time, Abu Dhabi said it faced some sanction-related difficulties for importing medical equipment from the United States. Arab states say while their relationship with China is strong, it's not overpowering. That's the kind of ties these states never experienced before, since the US has always tried to control them. The Arabs say their cooperation with China is not going to hurt their relationship with the United States. But as the new Arab generation is inclining more towards the East, is it far-fetched to assume the next generation would put Washington out of their map?
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. Bismillah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. On the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, Khamenei.ir publishes excerpts from Ayatollah Khamenei's statements about Imam Hassan alayhi salam and his peace treaty. Regarding the issue of Imam Hassan's peace treaty, we have mentioned several times in books have been written that under the same conditions, anyone, even the commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, would not have done anything differently, but exactly what Imam Hassan did. No one can say that a fraction of Imam Hassan's actions were questionable. No. What His Majesty did is 100% accurate based on irrefutable logical arguments. Among the lineage of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, who is the most enthusiastic? Who gained the most in life from his martyrdom? Who was the most courageous in protecting the religion against the enemy? It was Hussein ibn Ali, peace be upon him. Imam Hussein ibn Ali and Imam Hassan accompanied one another on the peace treaty. The peace treaty was not realized by Imam Hassan alone. Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein both had a role in it. However, Imam Hassan was leading, and Imam Hussein devotedly followed him. Imam Hussein alayhi salam was among defenders who acknowledged the concept of Imam Hassan's peace treaty. Once in a private gathering, a close companion of the Imam's opposed Imam Hassan for the treaty. Imam Hussein silenced him. No one can ever claim that had it been Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the peace treaty would not have been carried through. No, Imam Hussein accompanied Imam Hassan. And even if Imam Hassan alayhi salam was not in the picture and Imam Hussein was alone, he would have done exactly the same thing under the same conditions. Diplomatic skills mean acquiring flexibility and power skillfully and promptly. Another definition for it would be heroic flexibility, for which Imam Hassan alayhi salam's peace treaty is the most glorious historical example. Heroic flexibility, unlike some interpretations, has clear meaning, an example of which can be found in wrestling competitions that aim at defeating the enemy. If someone has strength but does not use flexibility where needed, they will certainly be defeated. However, if they use their flexibility and power promptly, they can pin the rival down to the mat.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
12-year-old boy, the grandson of Iran's health minister, Bahram Einollahi. Mohammad Sadra received a Sinopharm shot with the presence of the health minister and local media outlets to encourage Iranian families to vaccinate their children with peace of mind.
I urge all families who have children between the ages of 12 and 18 to send their kids for vaccination. This way we can reopen in-person school classes safely in the upcoming months. I brought my grandson today to get the vaccine to prove that vaccines will bear no harm for children.
Iran has so far administered more than 58 doses of COVID vaccines. This means 68% of Iran's population has received at least one shot. This number was less than 10% around 2 months ago, when President Ebrahim Raisi took over power from his predecessor. Iran managed to accelerate the inoculation campaign by speeding up imports of foreign-made jabs, as well as supporting local vaccine developers.
Only in Tehran, more than 10 million people have been fully vaccinated. This is over 70% of the capital's population. The vaccination of lower ages will definitely help us get our kids back to school safely.
Based on the international health guidelines, minus 18 age groups should receive a single dose of COVID vaccine. The Iranian health minister said the country has taken the same approach and will administer one shot to its adolescents. He said once this phase is over, the health ministry will start vaccinating students between 7 and 12 years old.
While Iran lagged behind in the national inoculation program, it has managed to be among the first to inoculate its teenage population. If all goes as planned, children can go back to schools in less than 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian farmers have held a rally outside the United Nations headquarters in Gaza City to condemn the Israeli ban on the export of their produce to the occupied West Bank and abroad. The Palestinians handed a letter to the representative of the United Nations, also protesting the obstacles and restrictions imposed by the Israeli regime on the international marketing of their crops.
The price of tomatoes is dropping and we are not making any profits. This is because there is no export to the West Bank or any other country. Palestinian farmers are living in hard conditions and have a limited source of income. The Israeli regime forces us to remove the tomatoes covers for exports, and this causes damage before they make it to the markets. We want the borders to open so that we can export our crops, and we demand imports of the required tools for farming.
Palestinian farmers say large quantities of their crops are piled up at Kerm Abu Salem, which is the only gateway out of the Gaza Strip, and are damaged. They say the Israeli regime has imposed impossible conditions on the exports. The Palestinians say they depend on the crops as their only source of income, adding that the regime seeks to destroy their livelihoods.
No crops are allowed to enter other markets. We demand an urgent opening of the borders so our crops can reach the West Bank in the same day they are exported, so the produce get there fresh.
This rally is held to protest the persistent Israeli restrictions on exports of Palestinian crops from Gaza to the West Bank. The impossible conditions that the Israeli regime imposed are aimed at damaging Palestinian crops and preventing the farmers from having a better income. This is a systematic policy to collapse the Palestinian economy and isolate it from the world. Farmers here call on the international community to stop these restrictions. The estimated daily loss for Palestinian farmers is very high.
The Israeli regime keeps imposing restrictions on Palestinian traders and farmers, keeping them from exporting their crops. Palestinian traders and farmers called on the international community to stop these restrictions that led to serious financial losses and dealt a blow to the Palestinian economy. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
see a ring of steel and a little army of police, think the British Conservative Party. Here in Manchester for their annual conference, with the party leader pitching his Building Back Better mantra yet again. Crashing the party, thousands of protesters from far and wide to tell the Prime Minister he and his clique are not welcome.
There's an array of groups and people who have gathered here today to demonstrate against the Conservative government pretty much everything it stands for, from its domestic policy to foreign policy, from its pandemic response and its position on migrants to its participation in foreign wars and its support for foreign occupation.
And they say examples of the government's failures aren't too difficult to find.
There's a gigantic economic catastrophe threatening the lives of ordinary people. There's a gigantic climate catastrophe threatening the whole planet. There is every reason why we can't trust a government of the rich, for the rich, to deal with these problems.
Another reason that's brought these demonstrators here, the controversial policing bill that gives UK police sweeping powers.
They don't need more powers. They need to be engaging with people in a protective way, not in a way where it's oppressive.
As a result of what critics call conservative government inaction, the UK has experienced one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, massive economic downturn, a humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, hiking taxes, fuel disruptions, and a rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia in recent years.
I want to make it really clear to the Tories that they're not welcome in this city, that actually their position on fueling racism, targeting refugees, is absolutely disgusting, and therefore we want to make sure that they know just how angry we are.
A decade of conservative rule in the UK has led to a groundswell of public dissatisfaction, which experts say will manifest itself in the 2024 general election. Saeed Puriza, Manchester.
Tears were shed and prayers held in London's Marble Arch, bringing the sights and sounds of Karbala to thousands that gathered there from all over the UK. People from different backgrounds, but all with one thing in common, their love for the Prophet's grandson, who was martyred on the sands of Karbala in the year 680.
This is an extension of the world's largest peaceful procession. And despite the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of people have taken part this year to commemorate Imam Hussein and his family's sacrifice and evoke their message.
Imam Hussein and his family symbolize so many things for those that hold him in their hearts, hope for the oppressed being one of them.
This is the message of Karbala. He did it so that oppression and oppressors could be brought to light. And, people who are innocent, they have hope. So it's a message of hope as well, that you're not alone in this world. There are great personalities, there are people in the world who are ready to fight for you, to die for you.
What Imam Hussein's family went through after his martyrdom is also a focal point of Arba'een, and the role the women played in the struggle.
We don't need to kind of look to secular role models to take on wholesale this kind of Marxist feminism. We already have women within the family of the Holy Prophet, who had great strength and great dignity. And the important thing is knowledge. This is what we should be as women. We should